This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome along. My name's Dan. Thank you so much for giving a listen to a brand new brain-busting edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the show where we speed across the universe. We look at all the epic and deadly stuff that's within, and we get you back within about half an hour, so fingers crossed no one notices that you're gone. Now today, we're chatting about one of the most venomous snakes in the whole world. Also, we'll hear about a new way that scientists are hoping to find aliens. And we'll get a proper science expert on the show in just a sec to answer a question that you have sent in, something that's niggling away at your brain. First, let's figure out how it exactly is that you are listening to what I'm saying right now. Like, what do your ears really do? How do they work? We can find out with one of our favourite geniuses here at Fun Kids. It's Professor Hallux.
Hallux's Hearing Help Desk.
I do hope Dr. Malleus can figure out what's wrong with your ears soon.
You want a few beers soon? Bit early, nurse, for beer.
This is hopeless.
Fancy a game of trump cards while we wait for our appointment? Look, there's a special hearing edition you can download.
Really? Gosh, so there is. Common Ear Complaints Edition. They really do make a pack for everything.
We had such fun with plot trumps on holiday, didn't we?
Common Ear Complaints Edition is ready to play.
Let's hope this is slightly less, icky than plot trumps.
Ha, I don't think so. Check out this card, Earwax. It's an 8 for ickiness.
Earwax is a combination of dead skin and oil from modified sweat glands.
Ew, but look, it's got a pretty high score for powers.
Earwax is the ear's way of cleaning itself. Dead skin is drawn out of the ear by the wax, which also offers protection against water and other things such as bugs. What's more, it can help protect the body from germs. Even when wax becomes stuck in the ear canal, it acts like an earplug blocking sounds from hitting the eardrum. If there's too much wax, it can be softened with wax softening drops and flushed out or removed by a doctor or nurse.
Very interesting. Let's see what card I've got. Here's one. Poking.
Choking?
Hallux.
Only joking. So what's the scores on the doors for poking?
Damage, 8. A common cause of ear problems is that something has been poked into the ear canal. Even a Q-tip can cause damage to the delicate skin and can push the earwax into a big sticky lump. Poking things into your ears is also a good way for germs to get stuck in your ear.
Got a good score for avoidability, that one. Just keep pointy things out of your ears.
What's next? Foreign objects? Hang on, what's wrong with foreign objects? I love a nice French croissant. And what's wrong with the Statue of Liberty? That's foreign. What's that got to do with ear holes?
It just means something that isn't normally found there.
Foreign objects are small objects such as beads and food, which can block sound or poke the eardrum and cause a hole. It's a common ear complaint in young children.
Low ick factor, but high for avoidability. Don't put beads or food in your ears, or in your nose, or up your...
All right, we get the idea, Professor. Look, this ear complaint's got a really low score for rarity. It's called otitis media.
Didn't they buy Manchester United the other year?
It's the name of a condition, silly.
And it's meant to be very common? Doesn't sound very common. I've never heard of it before in my life.
Otitis media is an ear infection that happens in your middle ear and is the most common cause of hearing loss in children. If you've ever had an earache, you've probably had otitis media. More than 85% of all children will get this at some point. Germs from the throat and other areas can build up and obstruct the narrow canals inside the ear, causing pain and hearing loss.
Sounds nasty, although it has a good score for curability. Antibiotics, a special type of medicine, are sometimes used, or it clears up on its own.
Hey, look at this one. It's called swimmer's ear. Now, it's not particularly common, but remember, you've got this hearing problem after the scientific swimming gala. Maybe that's what you have.
This painful infection occurs when the ear canal remains wet after bathing or swimming. It can cause the ear canal to swell shut, causing a temporary hearing loss.
Professor Hallux to room 3, please.
Looks like Dr. Malleus is ready for us.
She's on a bus. She's going to miss our appointment at this rate. Hallux's Hearing Help Desk, with support from Phonak. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Hallux.
Now remember, if you love listening to the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and if you want a shout out on the show, the easiest way to get it done is to leave a review for us over on the iTunes podcast store. It's so simple. Open it up on your phone or tablet, whatever. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly and write a review. Now, there are a few things you need to do. You need to leave your name so I know who to give the shout out to. Drop us 5 stars if you can as well. That'll help me pronounce your name properly. And there's a little box at the bottom. And in there, you can write us a message. So it could be a shout out. It could be something you want to tell me about how much you love science. Or it could be a question, something that's been niggling your brain that you want a proper expert to answer for you. We've got one of those on the show doing just that in a few minutes. So that's what you need to do. If you want to get a shout out on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, open up the iTunes podcast store and leave us a review. So if you've got a science question that you want answering, you need to let me know. You can do it as a review over on the iTunes podcast store. And I'll do my best to find a proper science expert in that field to come on the show and sort it out for you. Now, this was sent in from Wilkie08, who's from Melbourne in Australia, who asks, he wants to know what hermit crabs eat. So on the phone, we've got Professor Mark Briffer, who's from the University of Plymouth. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Hi.
Mark, very quickly, just outline your credentials. What makes you worthy of answering a question about hermit crabs?
Oh, blimey, that's a good question. Well, I worked out the other day that I've been studying hermit crabs since 1995, which is probably before your listeners, or many of your listeners were born anyway, isn't it? So, yes, I've been studying them for a long time. I'm interested mainly in how they behave and how they fight each other over the little snail shells that they live in.
So before we get deep into it, let's start at the beginning. What is a hermit crab?
Right, a hermit crab is not really a crab. So it is a crustacean, and it is closely related to what we would normally think of as true crabs, the sort of things that you can easily find on most beaches, certainly in the UK, with a typical slightly compressed crab-like body and two big claws, and walking legs that you might see scuttling about in a rock pool. They're actually more closely related to some animals called squat lobsters. If anyone likes eating scampi, it probably means you've eaten squat lobster, which is similar to a crab, but its abdomen is kind of curled underneath its body a little bit, not completely like it is in a true crab. And in a hermit crab, the abdominal part of its body is really, really strange for a crustacean. It's not tucked under its body at all, but more importantly, it's not covered by a hard exoskeleton, so it's all sort of soft and squidgy and vulnerable to predators. And this is where hermit crabs get their name from, because to protect this part of their body, instead of having their own shell, most of them stick their abdomen into empty snail shells, which they carry around with them. A bit like a little portable house that they can hide in whenever they're threatened.
And how much of their time do you predict is spent inside a shell and how much is spent outside of it?
Oh, well, if you mean how much of their time do they spend occupying a shell, then pretty much all of their time. Because if they find themselves without a shell, hopefully for the individual hermit crab concerned, that's a very brief time without a shell, because they're incredibly vulnerable if their abdomen is exposed. And a hermit crab without a shell won't survive very long because of predators in its environment. But another way you can look at that question is how much time do hermit crabs spend fully kind of pulled back into their shell and hiding, and how much time do they spend with their legs and their head and their claws out of the shell, scuttling about. And in my experience, they will only hide in their shells in response to a direct threat, or what they perceive as a direct threat. Now, this could be a predator, or it could be something as simple as a person looking at the hermit crabs. And if you overshadow a hermit crab in a rock pool, it will very quickly pull itself tightly into its shell, as tightly as it can to avoid what it would see as a threat. Pretty soon, though, they'll come out and scuttle about again. And the reason for that is that hiding in your shell is good for avoiding predators, but it's bad for other things. The more time you spend hiding in your shell, the less time you spend looking for food and mates. So they will try to minimise the amount of time they spend tightly hiding inside their shells.
You mentioned right at the start of the chat, hermit crabs fighting for snail shells.
That's right, yes.
Tell us more.
But that's what makes them really interesting. If you're, well, I mean, it's one of the things that makes them really interesting if you're interested in understanding how animals behave, because they've got a problem which most animals have, and that is that the resources that they need in order to survive and grow are in quite a limited supply. And that means that in order to get hold of those resources, the best way is often to take it off another member of the same species who will be reluctant to give it up, and therefore fighting is the result. So, yes, hermit crabs need these empty snail shells, as we've already discussed. The problem they've got is, as they grow, they need bigger and bigger shells to provide protection. So it's not that they can just find one shell and that will do them for their whole life. So this means they're constantly, as they grow, on the lookout for bigger and bigger shells, and every so often they're going to have to find a larger home to move into, as there aren't just lots of perfectly sized empty snail shells lying around in their habitat. Very often this means they have to take it from another hermit crab. And I've been studying how they do that for all these years. That's my main interest.
Does it tend to be the same species of snail that they take the shells from? Because I just know that nature works in such a delicate balance system. Everything's quite circular. Is there something in place where a standard type of snail will die, it will leave its shell vacated just at the same time as a hermit crab needs one? Is that a thing?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that nature ever puts anything in place for animals. I think it's all much more of a bit of a free-for-all. But they definitely have their preferences for particular species of snail shell. So the type of hermit crab I work on likes periwinkle shells, ideally. But if they can't find a periwinkle shell that's the right size, they'll make do with a dogwelt shell or a top shell. So yes, you do tend to find them mainly in a particular species of shell, but certainly with the hermit crabs that we find in the UK, they've got definite preferences for what they really like.
Right, let's get the question answered, shall we? This is from Wilkie08 from Melbourne. They want to know, right, what do hermit crabs eat?
Right, Wilkie, that's a very good question. The answer is pretty much everything and anything. So they are omnivores, which means they will eat animal material and basically little bits of seaweed if they have to. They're not very predatory. There have been a few reports of hermit crabs taking snails out of their shells, attacking snails. I've never seen that happen. I suspect if that does happen, it's a very, very sort of rare occurrence, and it might have been a snail that wasn't in the best condition in the first place. But they're basically scavengers. So they will scavenge about in rock pools, looking for animals that are already dead or little particles of food that are mixed up in with the sand, and that's what they will eat. And they spend quite a lot of time, if you've ever spent much time watching hermit crabs, sifting through the sand with their claws, looking for little particles of food trapped between the sand grains.
Brilliant. So it's an as and when situation. Fantastic. Professor Mark Briffer from the University of Plymouth, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And remember, if you've got a question that you want a proper science expert to answer, let me know over as a review on the iTunes podcast store. It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we talk about the most mean and deadly things that exist in the universe. Today, we've got a snake with the longest fangs in the world. The Gaboon Viper is found in the rainforests of Africa. It's light and dark green. It's got the colours forming diamonds that stretch the length of its back. Now, it's got quite a low, flat head, really. It looks like the top of an arrow from a playing card. But at the top of that head, it's got horns. Tiny little horns, though. And horns, you always know that means it's mean. But when it opens its mouth, though, nothing is tiny. It's got fangs that can grow up to 2 inches tall. That's about 5 centimetres, which is about the size of your little finger. Doesn't look too big when you hold your hand up, but imagine that in a snake's mouth. Starts to feel massive, doesn't it? And when it clamps those teeth down, it injects a poison that causes quick swelling, blisters, bruising, bleeding, and even death. And it also gives out more venom than any other snake. The thing is, the good side, it's not massively aggressive. It's quite a slow, sluggish beast. But if you do find one in the jungle, if you stumble across its home, if you anger it, you need to make sure that you move away very quickly before you see those huge teeth, because before you know it, they'll be clamping down and there's a massive load of venom coming. Right, it's time to get another episode from our Britain's Digital Railways series. This is where Bex from the Club on Fun Kids and I, we jump on a train, we head all over the UK to have a look at how the rails will work in the future.
Britain's Digital Railways. Since the earliest days of rail, trains have been controlled by their very own highway code to keep them a safe distance apart. Every railway line is divided up into sections called blocks, where only one train at a time is allowed to be. Signalling has kit attached to tracks to determine whether or not a train is in a section. This kit includes track circuits, which send a small electrical current between the tracks and the trains, and axle counters, which count the wheels going in and out of a section. If the numbers match, the section is clear for the next train. Trackside signals control entry into and out of each block and also warn trains when the line ahead might be occupied and if they must reduce speed. And just like on a road, there are also speed limit signs, reducing speeds in built-up areas and where there are hazards. There's lots of ways to make sure everyone stays safe, as Bex and Dan find out.
Come on! What are we waiting for?
Oh, we stopped at a signal. You know, one of those traffic lights by the side of the line.
Can you see it?
Let me look. Yeah, it's red. That means stop. Did you know that the latest signals are controlled by computers that know exactly where all the trains are and what speed they're going?
That's pretty cool. But how do they make sure trains followed the rules before electric lights and computers?
I think they used flags to make the signals.
Bex is right. In the earliest days of rail travel, policemen would stand along the track and use flags to tell train drivers if the track ahead was clear. But as they couldn't communicate with neighbouring policemen, the only way to do this was to time each train as it came past and leave a set amount of time before letting the next one pass.
But what if the previous train had stopped unexpectedly? There might be a crack.
As trains started to get faster and more frequent, things had to change. Mechanical semaphore signals controlled by signalmen were introduced. The signalmen could now also communicate with each other using bells and lamps. There were two main types of semaphore signals. A stop signal consists of a red, square-ended arm with a vertical white stripe. When in the horizontal position, a stop signal must never be passed, as the line immediately ahead may not be clear. At night, a red light would show when set at danger, and a green light when clear. The second type was called the distance signal. It has a yellow arm with a black chevron and a V notch cut out at the end. It tells drivers to be careful as they approach the next stop signal. Whilst it may be passed, a driver must slow his train to be ready to stop at the signal. From the 1960s, traffic light signals began to be used to control trains, with signals able to show cautionary yellow as well as stop and go, red and green, as well as being easier to see, as they were controlled by relays and computers, rather than mechanical metal rods, they are more reliable. With modern technology advancing all the time, signalling has definitely come into the 21st century. The railways use a train detection system, which can tell signallers exactly where every train is and how fast they're going. There are also systems that can automatically stop trains if the driver doesn't take the correct course of action or passes through a red signal, all helping the railways to run smoothly and safely.
And we're off! Green for go!
Britain's Digital Railway, with support from the Royal Academy of Engineering. Find out more at funkidslive.com/railway.
You're listening to the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and it's time for this week's Science in the News. A gigantic plastic hoover is headed into the sea to suck up all the waste that is damaging our planet. It's a 600-metre long tube. It looks kind of like a giant snake. It will float in a U-shape on top of the sea, and it's got a net to herd and collect all the plastic that's bobbing about the ocean. Now, the crazy thing is, this is all the brainchild, the idea of a Dutch teenager, and he thought it up when he was swimming in Greece about 7 years ago. Also, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he said that if the world doesn't change course by 2020, climate change, it could run away from us. After a summer of weather devastation, fierce storms and wildfires all over the globe, he says that if we don't think quickly, the corals will keep dying, the ocean will become more toxic, and even more carbon dioxide will flood into the sky. And finally, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope is hoping to find more alien life. It's hoping to launch in 2021. It will orbit the sun 1.5 million kilometres away from the Earth, and using a massive golden mirror, it's thought it will detect whether atmospheres of other planets are modified to life just like ours. That is it for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly then. Thank you so much for giving us a listen, for giving us a chance, for downloading and pressing play. Remember, if you want a shout out on the show in the next few weeks, you need to let me know. You can do that over on the iTunes podcast store. And if that's and if you've got a science question that's niggling around your brain, maybe something that you've been told by a teacher and you think, how can that be true? Or maybe something you were told by your mate who's known to lie a little bit in the playground, and you just think, there's no way that can be true. I can find out for you. I can answer a science expert on your behalf. All you need to do is to let me know the question. The best place to do that is by leaving a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on the iTunes podcast store. And while you're over on iTunes, that's one of the best places to hear all our brilliant science series. You can find them on there, on the free Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com. And you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app for a phone and tablet, and over at funkidslive.com. See you later. Thank you so much. Bye.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.